You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
This is Kick-Ass Politics. I'm Ben Mathis. Hi, folks. Before we start the show, I want to ask for your help. If you enjoy Kick-Ass Politics, I hope you'll help us reach our goal of raising our full production budget for 2016 by donating on our website at kickasspolitics.com or at gofundme.com/kickasspolitics. Thanks for listening, and now enjoy the show. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis, and welcome to Kick-Ass Politics. When disaster strikes, my guest today snaps into action. He's Stephen McAndrews, head of emergency operations for the International Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies in Geneva. And for the past two decades, he's been on the front line of natural disasters in Asia, Africa, South America, Haiti, the Caribbean, and the Middle East, including the super typhoon that hit the Philippines in 2014, the Ebola outbreak in Sierra Leone, the recent Nepal earthquake, and in Lebanon, Jordan, and Greece as head of emergency operations for the Syrian refugee crisis. Today, we'll talk about the process when crisis strikes and the Red Cross has to mobilize a disaster response effort within hours, and we'll talk about the problems presented by a very different type of disaster, as an estimated 9 million desperate Syrian refugees flood neighboring countries in the Middle East and Europe. We'll talk about the daunting task he had when trying to contain the Ebola virus in Sierra Leone and how it required re-educating Africans about long-held superstitions and rituals regarding health, medicine, and funeral traditions. Coming up with Stephen McAndrews, head of emergency operations for the Red Cross, in just a moment.
To Washington, it's time for Kick-Ass Politics. And now here's your host, Ben Mathis.
My guest today is Stephen McAndrew. Steve is the head of emergency operations for the International Federation of the Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies. Over his 15 years with the Red Cross, he has helped with responses to natural disasters in Asia, Africa, South America, Haiti, and the Caribbean. And now, most recently, he's coordinating the Red Cross Red Crescent effort to aid the more than 500,000 Syrian refugees displaced and living in Jordan. Stephen McAndrew, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you. I think you read from an old bio there, actually.
Uh-oh.
Jordan was my last response in 2014.
After Jordan.
I headed.
You need to update your bio over there then.
Yeah, I did. I think that's an old one. I sent them. I mean, after Jordan, I was head of operations for the Red Cross response to Ebola in West Africa.
Okay, right. I have that.
Okay, then I was head of Nepal earthquake response last year. And I'm just recently returned from Greece, the European migrant operation.
Okay. First of all, I'm curious about your general process when dealing with any kind of disaster. And then I want to talk about the Syrian refugee crisis. when a disaster hits somewhere in the world and you have to quickly mobilize an operation, walk us through that. What are usually the first things that you do?
Well, every day there's disasters that hit somewhere in the world. So if we have a national society like we have here in the United States, we have the American Red Cross, they will respond to all sorts of disasters every day of the year. When a disaster gets beyond the capacity of the National Red Cross and the national government to respond, then they make a request for international assistance. And that's when the International Red Cross, my organization, that's when we get involved. And what we do immediately is start to mobilize resources. And those resources are mobilized based on an assessment of the needs. So we really need information quickly as to what are the needs, where are they, how much. And we do a lot of the basic work, food, water, shelter, health care. We have field hospitals. People get treated under injuries, earthquake injuries. So that's, we do all the basic health care services needed. We also do recovery service as time goes on. We help people get back to work and get back into their houses.
So the moment something hits, what is the very first thing that you prioritize?
Well, it's depends where it hits and what it is that
what
hits.
What it is. Okay.
Right? So yeah, when an earthquake
hits, situational.
Okay. Like an earthquake, for example, we know there's going to be a lot of injuries. So we know that food, water, shelter, and healthcare will be needed. But other events take some time. Flooding takes a bit longer. And a lot of times, flooding will grow and grow and grow, and then it'll start to spread to different areas. So we look at different things like mobilization of people, setting up shelters, as opposed to dealing with injured people.
Like we said, you've overseen any number of disaster responses dealing with natural disasters. You have the 2010 earthquake in Haiti, the Ebola breakout in Sierra Leone, the super typhoon that hit the Philippines in 2014. How is handling the response to a natural disaster different than what's been taking a lot of your time recently, which is dealing with the Syrian refugee crisis?
Well, there's a lot of differences. With a natural disaster like an earthquake, almost from 1 hour after the event, people are starting to get their lives back together. Mm-hmm. And there's not too much movement of population. So in that type of response, our challenge is to really line up with the people on the ground and how they're working and what they're trying to get together with and how they're trying to put their lives back together and just line up with them. Now, the current migrant crisis is completely opposite. People are on the move. I've never managed an operation like this in all my years where we are actually trying to help people and we're running next to them. They're actually literally running. They hit the beaches in Greece and Lesbos and some of the islands and they run and we're running next to them, trying to give them first aid, trying to give them food, trying to give them all the help we can, water and information. So it's a real big difference because every day it's a new set of people we're dealing with also.
Is that the biggest landing point for refugees right now coming into Europe?
At the moment, yes. The biggest landing point, the biggest entry point is Greece.
Okay.
Over 850,000 people arrived to Greece by water last year in 2015. But things are changing now. So now the borders are really tightening up. There's a new agreement with the EU and Turkey, and people are starting to be sent back from Greece. So this could change again. Early last year, the main entry point was Italy. People were leaving from Tunisia and Libya.
Yeah.
And even Spain, they were going across. So it may change again.
Now, are these mostly refugees from Syria or Libya?
About 50% of them were Syrians.
Okay.
The second largest group was Iraqis, and the third was Afghans. After that, there's multiple nationalities. About 3% were Moroccans, Pakistanis, many North Africans. And this really creates a big challenge because they have different status and different agreements with different governments.
Yeah, and how do you coordinate that with the government of Greece? I mean, I'm assuming that they have different priorities than the Red Cross.
Absolutely. So, yes, the government of Greece is trying their best, but it should be remembered it's a country that is really broke, and they're going through austerity measures now, so they can barely keep their services going for their own people. Many of the people we work with, many of the government agents there we work with, haven't been paid in months, or they get paid 20% salary. They lost their pensions last year. So Greece is already struggling to handle services with its own people.
Yeah.
And now they have to deal with all these new arrivals. So it's very difficult.
So you've handled that crisis both in Europe and in the Middle East. What's the first thing that they need when they arrive at a Red Cross camp?
Well, it's very different in the different places where they arrive. Mm-hmm. So, for example, in Jordan, there's some refugee camps that we function in that are right on the border with Syria. So people arrive there, and they've only driven an hour or two from their home. And it's an Arabic-speaking country, and they sometimes go back and forth into Syria, some of those refugees, and still try to maintain a business.
Oh, really?
In a quasi-war zone, yes.
Wow.
So it's quite a different challenge than people arriving to Greece and Europe, because the arrivals coming into Europe, and specifically Greece, first of all, they're just wet. They have rafts made for 15 people, and the traffickers put 50 people in those rafts. Huh. They give them a knife, they give them a motor, and they point to Greece, and they say, go. So sometimes those families, if you have a family of eight and you get the last four spots on one raft, it doesn't matter. They will send that raft, and then another raft will be sent with the other four family members. And there's waves and wind currents. They may end up on different islands. The rafts sink. The reason they're given a knife is because they're told if they get close to Greece, you punch a hole in the raft and it starts to sink. So the law of the sea says you must be, if you're rescued at sea, you must be taken to the nearest land. So they do this sometimes a couple yards off the shore.
Huh.
The beaches in Greece are filled with rafts. The second thing to remember here is that over 50% of these migrants are not Syrians. And many of them will throw their passports in the ocean. So the reason they do that, as soon as they touch land in Greece, they are in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And they can say, many of them are claiming, I'm Syrian. You must accept me as a Syrian refugee.
Okay.
And so just think of the challenge a government has to prove them wrong. You can't really prove someone wrong. You could look at them and say, maybe you don't look Syrian, but many of them are North Africans and they look and sound and talk alike. So it's very hard.
Right.
There's a lot of undocumented.
If you're Moroccan and you say you're a Syrian, then they can't turn you away because you're a refugee.
Yes. And where are they going to turn you away to?
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
You can't really deport someone to a country that they say they're not from.
I don't know if it's different from when you were in Jordan and Lebanon handling the crisis versus Greece, but when refugees come to another country or to the Red Cross, do they mix in with the general population or are they kept in camps or how does that work?
So it's definitely different. In Lebanon, right now, about one in every four persons is a Syrian refugee, and they have very much integrated in. They integrate in, but there are also camps in valleys, in the Bekaa Valley. There's migrants living under bridges. In Beirut, you can see migrants everywhere. Mm-hmm. But many of them also are integrated because there's a long history of family ties and language. In Jordan, there's big camps, and they are mostly dealing with Syrians. And they're keeping them somewhat confined to camps. But they can integrate somewhat well, but there's a different legal status they get there. Can they attend schools? Can they get a job? Are they allowed to work?
Okay.
Things like that. Now, the ones who are coming to Europe, when they hit Greece, almost none of them want to stay in Greece. They want to move on.
Well, there are no jobs in Greece.
There's no jobs. Yeah. No one. You have to speak Greek to really function in Greece.
Mm-hmm.
There's no family links. And there's no real future of work. So even there's a lot of people in Greece that are kind of leaving Greece to go work elsewhere. So there's no reason to stay there. They're only passing through. So it's a real different challenge for us. Many of those people hit the islands in Greece and they're out within 48 hours.
Really?
But just as of last week, the borders are now fully closed. So currently, it's estimated there's 100,000 people stuck in Greece today.
Which borders are we talking about? The border of
Bulgaria has been closed for a long time. The border with Albania has been closed for a long time. The only land border that was open was Macedonia. Mm-hmm. And the Macedonian border started tightening up last December. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly, in the middle of December, there was a policy decision by Macedonia, Croatia, Slovenia, and Serbia that was not coordinated or maybe not communicated and was not, it's not part of the EU, where they said, we're not going to let anyone else in except Iraqis, Syrians, and Afghans. Mm-hmm. So that cut out about 20% of the migration. Now, 20% of a million people in the move is a lot of people.
Yeah.
Since then, recently, it's been completely closed. So the Macedonian border. So now nobody can walk out of Greece.
Interesting.
Now, the challenge of Greece is that there's dozens, if not hundreds, of little islands. Mm-hmm. There's no way you can really close that border unless you have a naval blockade 24 hours a day, chasing people around in rafts.
Yeah.
The problem is the European Union is physically split in two locations. So Greece is an outlier, mm-hmm. and then there's some country, the Balkan countries in between, and then you start getting into Austria and Germany. Most people, they're the final destination, we've done surveys, is Germany, about 50%, then Sweden, Norway, Austria, Finland, because they have history there. They have family there. They have brothers working.
There's
people.
Okay.
There's migrant, you know, Syrian communities that have been there for generations. So they have connections. That's their final destination.
Europe seems to be bearing a lot of the brunt of this right now. Are the neighbors of Syria and Iraq and these other countries in the Middle East, are they doing enough to take in the refugees and do their part?
Well, I think some of them have been absolutely stellar in doing their part. So Turkey has over 2 million refugees. Over 2 million refugees. There's no other country in the world that probably could handle that amount and do it well like they're doing. So the Red Crescent in Turkey has, we have 19 camps. Kids are given school. There's food. There's everything. They're even given somewhat work permits. But there's a limit to what they can do. So Turkey's kind of the fabric of Turkish society is feeling the pressure of this amount of refugees. Now, other neighbors like Lebanon, they one in every four person is a refugee. So how much more can they take? And there's not a lot of work, and it's not a big country. Jordan, I think, has done. They're doing their part also. I mean, they have many Syrians there. They have giant camps. They're doing their best. But there's other neighbors that are doing less, doing more. So it's
the Saudis. I don't see them taking in many.
Saudis do not seem to be taking any in that I'm aware of. But
well, in Europe, there are obviously big cultural differences that have become a problem.
It's easy to say a clash of cultures or cultural differences, but really, what are the specifics of that? And I think some of the specifics could be somewhat the separation of church and state. We take that for granted, right? The separation of church and state.
Right.
And many of these refugees are coming where that is a concept that's never even doesn't exist.
Right. It permeates everything.
Right. The government is the church.
Yeah.
I mean, the Islamic Republic of Iran is an Islam. Why would it's not separated? They're trying to. So people are raised with a different mindset about their religion, for one. And that leads into other things like treatment of women or non-treatment of women.
Right.
The second, I think that integration is a great word, but it's a very difficult thing to achieve.
Well, yeah.
So, I mean, and when you get more and more numbers, a 1 hour discussion at a reception center with someone who's just lost half their family in the ocean, climbed over a mountain, went through tear gas in the Balkans, has been on a 3 month journey to give a 1 hour integration discussion on how we act here.
Yeah.
It's really not going to sink in. So I think the horizon for planning on integration probably needs to be extended. It takes generations to integrate. It takes years, and maybe children that are born in a different country and raised there, then they can fully integrate. But I think it's a very, very difficult challenge.
Yeah, it seems like it. But is it a long-term situation? Are these people looking to move and restart, or are they just there as temporary migrants?
That's a great question. Now, many of them, So most of the Syrians that I've talked to personally, and even that we look at in our surveys, many of them would and would like to go back to Syria. Mm-hmm. Because in Syria is actually a fairly well-off country.
Right.
People are educated, and they like living there. So most of the Syrians will say, I would love to go back. And they probably go thinking that this will be temporary. Now, there's no end date on this war in Syria at this point in time.
Right.
They say, I would love to come back. But if you don't have a date, you have to assume you'll never go back.
Right.
Now, I think if the war in Syria were to stop, calm down, or some resolution, many would go back. But many of the others, like the two Dominicans I met, they're not planning on going back.
Yeah.
And many of the Asians, the Africans that are joining here, they're economic migrants. They're looking for a better life.
Well, we're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back to talk more with Stephen McAndrew, head of emergency operations for the International Red Cross. Back in just a moment. Hey, folks. Do you like reading, but you don't have the time? Then maybe it's time to start listening to audiobooks. Audiobooks are the perfect thing to listen to on your drive to work or on the treadmill at the gym, or how about while you're cooking dinner or relaxing in the tub? You don't have to carve out an hour or two of your day just to focus all your attention on reading a book anymore, because audiobooks are great just about anywhere. And right now, you can listen to an audiobook for free with a special promotion for our listeners from audible.com. Just go to audibletrial.com/kickasspolitics for a free 30-day trial and a free audiobook download, which can be any of Audible's 180,000 titles for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, iPad, or MP3 player. That's audibletrial.com/kickasspolitics, or click on the sponsor link on our webpage at kickasspolitics.com to download the free audiobook of your choice. And now, back to the show. We're back, and today I'm talking with Stephen McAndrew, head of emergency operations for the International Red Cross. Well, Stephen, usually the crises you're dealing with, at some point, there's a light at the end of the tunnel. And so from your position, you kind of have an idea of what you're dealing with. But when you're dealing with an indefinite crisis that's gone on for, 5 years now and no sign of resolution, is it ever a concern that eventually, volunteers get burnt out? You run out of human resources and financial resources. Is there a concern that those things could dry up when it goes on this long?
Absolutely. We're already feeling that.
Mm-hmm.
We are, our donors are feeling fatigue of supporting us. The needs kind of are increasing all the time, and things that we thought would be a simple, a feeding program in Jordan for a year is now going on 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
So absolutely. Our operations are, we're struggling. We're doing our best all over, but we definitely have a lot of tired people working hard all over the place. I can say as of now, as I sit here, the Syrian Red Crescent, they're still crossing battle lines today and distributing food and health and emergency medicines to people inside Syria. We've lost 54 Red Crescent volunteers in Syria since the beginning of this conflict. And, every day these guys, they get up, they put their uniforms on, and they go back to work.
Yeah,
these volunteers, and they're volunteers. There's no other team to be on in Syria. So I've had the honor of working with these people, and they tell me the only team that's really worthwhile in joining in Syria is the Red Crescent.
Yeah, and I'm curious, what is the difference between the Red Cross and Red Crescent? Is it just the difference of a symbol?
This is a great question.
I've always wondered that.
The Red Crescent and the Red Cross in any country that uses the Red Crescent and the Red Cross in other countries is basically the same organization doing the same thing. It has a history that goes back to 1873 when there was a war between the Russian Empire and the Ottomans. Mm-hmm. And the International Red Cross was hoping to get access to that battlefield. And the Ottomans said, well, we we view the Red Cross as a religious symbol, we would prefer to use the Red Crescent.
Well, so that, yeah, that's I how mean, it looks started. A lot like a Crusader symbol.
Yeah, and
from
so,
the Middle Ages.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So the Red Cross and the Red Crescent, they have a long history, but it's the same thing now. It's internationally recognized.
Okay. Is it Arabs that work on those teams? Is it a different group of people?
No, it's country.
It's entirely just the symbol.
Yeah, it's the same organization, but there's 33 countries now using the Red Crescent, and there's about 155 using the Red Cross, but it's the same organization doing the same thing. The same organization in Israel uses a Red Star of David. So there's now three symbols, but they do the same thing. They're neutral, doing the same services.
Well, that kind of brings up something else that I'm curious about. When you talk about going into a different culture and the issues of trust, you worked in Sierra Leone. In places like Africa, you have a lot of superstition about medicine and outsiders and so forth. I mean, for a long time, there were a lot of people that thought the cure for AIDS was to have sex with a virgin. In the Middle East, you have a lot of widespread conspiracy theories and distrust toward the West. Do you encounter that kind of distrust and misinformation, and how do you combat that?
Well, yes, we encountered it. We encounter it. We still do. The Ebola operation was really a big operation for us. It was one of my biggest challenges, how to deal with that. And what we had to do was, so it's hard to change people's culture, nor do we want to change their beliefs.
Right.
We just want to enlighten people and even use that strength to change practices so disease does not spread. So Ebola, it was really, I became an expert in it, but there's only three ways to get it. It's either you or someone has it and they just live on top of you and bleed all over you. And even then, someone who has it in a house of 10 people, only three will get it out of that. Or you work in a lab, you deal with the blood, you make a mistake, you follow protocol, you get it. Or the third, which was really the main source where it was spreading, was funeral practices.
Really?
So in West, yes.
Oh, that's right. I think I remember hearing about that. But I don't remember the specifics. Yeah, what was that about?
So in West Africa, funeral practices are beautiful practices. Bodies washed, and then everyone, loved ones, family members, they get to say goodbye. And the tradition is to touch the body, touch the forehead, kiss the body. It's really actually their final goodbye, and this is a deep-rooted tradition. And it just so happens that in Ebola, when a person dies, the most toxic time is after death, and the Ebola is kind of coming out through their pores. Huh. So that was really why it was spreading so much. And even in Sierra Leone, there was a great healer, natural healer in Sierra Leone. She went to Guinea to try to help someone with Ebola. Before it was identified, she came back. The person in, she was not able to cure the person in Guinea, came back over the border. She got it and she died. Now, she was a famous curer, you know, natural healer.
Okay.
And people came from all over Sierra Leone to her funeral. And they had a big funeral and they washed the body. And everyone at that funeral kissed that body. Within a week or two, we had Ebola in almost all the states there.
So it was
the funeral practices is really what was spreading the Ebola. So we had to change that.
How do you do that? Because you're challenging people's beliefs.
Yeah.
That's got to be a huge challenge.
It was a humongous challenge.
Yeah.
But the way we change people is really information campaigns, it's training. We used traditional West African ways of doing this, which is through music. And we did television shows. We had soap operas. We hired.
And then we
had burial teams.
That's smart.
Yeah, we had over 500 Red Cross volunteers doing burials. We were burying 100 people a day last year in November, 2014, I should say. And people started to listen. So we really have a good network in the Red Cross, and there's a Red Cross volunteer in each village somewhere. You'll find one, and he started doing campaigns. So our job is to give them the information, the equipment needed, the propaganda, radio shows, and we started just turning the tide through information.
Yeah, that's interesting. I didn't know that there was kind of a marketing element to what the Red Cross does, but that would be necessary, I would think.
Oh, yeah, it's a big, big part of what we do. It's a huge part of what we do. Even in the migrant crisis in Europe now, the biggest need is actually information. So some people are hitting the beaches in Greece and they think they're in Germany already.
Yeah.
Then they say, what do I do? Where do I go? How do I register? Where's my brother Charlie? You know, just, where's the medic? We have people coming up in the shore and throwing their diabetes medicine in the water because they say, hey, now I'm in Europe. I'm, you know, I don't need this stuff anymore. Yeah. Just information is really information. So I would say Ebola, it's it thrives in ignorance. That's really where it lives. It's on, I could give you a 10-minute talk after this interview, and you'll never get Ebola, even if you walk through the worst places where it is.
Because that's why here in the U.S., people realize that it's really not the kind of thing that we need to worry about here. Yeah. You know, I remember a few years ago around the holidays, we had this big concern in the U.S. about Ebola, and we had a handful of people who got quarantined. Was that a huge overreaction?
There was definitely an overreaction, but I understand the overreaction. The overreaction is because of lack of knowledge. Mm-hmm. So dealing with the unknown, people tend to take the super ultra conservative precautious response, which in a way is understandable. So I don't want
to be safe than sorry.
Better to be safe than sorry. And I don't want to criticize anybody or anything. And I think that as time went on, governments, especially the U.S. government, they got better at it and how they respond. I remember my first time flying back to the U.S. from my operations in Ebola and just filling out the form. And as soon as I say, yes, I'm working in Ebola in West Africa, kind of the whole, you know, the security apparatus at the airport going into, you know, reactionary mode.
Yeah.
And kind of being put in a room and with a table that's about 20 foot long and a guy down the other end with a shield on and almost a full hazmat suit.
Were you afraid they were going to quarantine you?
No, I'm not afraid. I was not afraid.
Was this when there was a lot of uncertainty?
There was a lot of uncertainty.
Was it in that era? Part like in the winter of, I guess, 2014, when a lot of people thought it was airborne, and then there were all kinds of crazy rumors and misinformation, people thinking that there were going to be internment camps and all this stuff.
Yes, that was the time. There was a lot of rumors flying around, and I heard they even closed the school somewhere in Chicago because somebody flew somewhere and talked with someone else who knew someone. I don't know the details of it, but there was definitely some major overreactions about Ebola. And that's all fear-based, really. But those first couple times I flew home for Christmas, and I would end up at the end of this interrogation kind of telling these guys all about how Ebola works. And
oh, really?
So, yes, and it was really, so it's about sharing knowledge. Some people did get put in quarantine, and there was major indignation, and then Skyping every night on the UN, just saying how horrible this is. But those workers, my coworkers, at least the ones that I was working with, I had to remind our teams, hey, we're dealing with fear, right? And people are scared. So the last thing you want to do when there's fear around is just say, this is ridiculous. Your fear isn't real.
Right.
Because then it makes it worse, actually.
And I was thinking to myself, what happened to that?
Yeah.
I found myself wondering, that was such a big deal for about a month. And then did it just disappear? We just forget?
Yeah. I think we're living in a world where we're getting more and more the mindset, well, someone else will take care of this mess. Right? So sooner or later, a big mess is going to come by that someone else is not going to take care of, that we're all going to have to come together to take care of. In Sierra Leone, they still have village meetings and the village elders, right?
Human conversations.
There's a dialogue and people listen to each other, and they will come together to make change. So depending upon the nature of the next outbreak, if it requires something more than an online solution, I don't know if we're going to be able to handle it. Because people... when a crisis hits, it's really hard to suddenly talk to your neighbors and friends if you haven't done it all along.
That's true. When you don't have that community built in.
Yeah.
When you see people who have lost everything and had their lives destroyed by an ongoing needless civil war involving a brutal dictator and a horrific terrorist pseudo-state, is it hard for you to have to deal with the fallout of those types of situations and not choose a side?
So for me, I mean,
how do you not do that?
For me, it's not hard.
Really?
Because I know, you know, just not taking one side or the other doesn't mean I'm not taking a side.
Mm-hmm.
We take the side of the victims.
Yeah.
Right? And that's the only side that I think is worthwhile to be on. I understand why we're doing what we do, and I understand what who we are in the Red Cross, and our neutrality gives us trust,
mm-hmm.
especially in conflict, especially working with governments. They know that we're not going to take one side or the other. It gives us access.
Yeah.
So we have access where no one else has access. Now, the price of neutrality is not cheap. So by being neutral, we do have to not denounce when we see something wrong. You know, and we see a lot of wrong.
Yeah, I would think that would be hard.
It is hard. Yeah, I mean, it's definitely hard. It's not for everybody. Some people really want to make a difference in a different way, which is good also. We have probably 40% of this migrant population's children. And some of those children, they're coming out of some of the worst, the darkest nightmare on the planet right now. And the stuff they're seeing and losing family members, and they come across on a boat, and half their family drowns off the boat, and they get punched and tear gassed, you know, at the borders through Europe.
Really?
But some of those 8-year-olds and 6-year-olds, they will make it.
Mm-hmm.
And some of those guys, some of those young kids, they're just going to be absolutely super powerful, honed humans for the future. That's what gives me hope. I say anyone that can really go through that and come out the other end, just kind of the way a diamond is formed at the most, you know, tumultuous, pressurized part of the planet, is the same way I think some of these young kids that are going through this. So I tell myself that, and I can help that process. Yeah. I help them get some food and some water and some shelter along the way, and maybe they'll remember that someone did care about them.
Yeah. What advice do you give to a Red Cross, Red Crescent volunteer who's working on their very first disaster?
Listening.
Really?
Yeah. The one thing I've learned the most, the thing I do the best in my career is I listen. I listen better than when I started. I still don't listen all the time. And I think a lot of people just don't listen at all. But if you need to help someone, in order to help someone, you really need to listen to them.
Yeah.
And that means put yourself in their shoes, see what they really need instead of our thought of how to help.
Mm-hmm.
So people will tell you what they need more so than what you think they need. And it's never the obvious.
Interesting. Well, what ways can people help and where should they go?
Well, if you want to help, wherever you are listening to this podcast, join your local Red Cross, Red Crescent chapter in any neighborhood here in the U.S. and all throughout the world. We have over 13 million volunteers worldwide. So
wow, that's great.
This is a giant organization and they do great stuff. So a lot of people I've met and say, oh, I want to do what you do. But there's very few of us really that kind of get on a plane and help across the world. Really, if you want to help the world, help your world wherever you are, you know, and find out what's going on. So right here in L.A., we have a great American Red Cross in Los Angeles. Is fantastic. You know, they do great work and all sorts of stuff. Join the Red Cross. And if you don't, the Red Cross is not for you. There's a lot of other organizations around. I can say after doing this many years, I've gotten so much more out of it than I put in. So this type of work.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's a good endorsement. And I'm assuming you don't turn down donations either.
That's right. No.
Donations are welcome.
Donations are definitely welcome. That's how we live. We live from donations. But really, the best someone can donate is even listening. You know, listening to this talk and showing interest in the world and your radio show. So I think raising awareness is more of a donation than cash or whatever. But we'll take both.
Okay. Well, great. Well, folks, you should do that. Well, you do wonderful work with the Red Cross, Red Crescent. Thanks so much for coming on the show and talking to me about it.
Well, thank you for having me, Ben. I wish you luck with your show here, and I really appreciate the time to have the voice of the Red Cross on the air.
All right. Well, keep doing all that great work you're doing out there in the world.
Thank you.
Thanks again to Stephen McAndrew for coming on the show. And if you'd like to get involved, find a Red Cross near you on the Red Cross's website at redcross.org. or you can learn more about the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies at ifrc.org. Be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass Politics on iTunes and leave us a review. And if you really want to help out, then donate to our GoFundMe campaign at gofundme.com/kickasspolitics or click the donate button on our website at kickasspolitics.com. Follow us on Twitter at KAPolitics or visit Kick-Ass Politics on Facebook and recommend Kick-Ass Politics to your friends on your social media. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickasspolitics.com. But for now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass Politics. Kick-Ass Politics is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.